because I know that you might think otherwise, I want you to know that there is no rule that a high holiday sermon has to begin with a joke. It's not in any rabbinic manual. We didn't learn that in class. But once a rabbi, a priest, and a minister were on a golf course. And they noticed that the foursome ahead of them was taking a long time. And you know, rabbis are very busy. They don't have a lot of time for golf. So they decided they would approach the foursome and ask them if they could hurry up. And they walk up to the foursome and they say, you know, it's taking a long time. And one of them turns around and says, you know, I'm sorry, but actually all of us are blind. And the priest says, oh my, well, bless you. Take all the time you need. We're sorry to have disturbed you. And the minister says, we think it's so beautiful that you would still gather together to do this. And the rabbi said, could you play at night? Now, when I mentioned to Rabbi Archon this morning that I was going to tell this joke, he said he likes the one about the Jew, Christian, and Muslim who are discussing their funerals, and the Muslim said, I hope what the Imam says is he was a good Muslim and he cared for his wife and for his children, for his family, and he's going to heaven. And the Christian says, and I hope he says that I cared for my community and my family and that I gave to my church and that I'm going to heaven. And the Jew said, I hope the rabbi goes, look, he's moving. There's a point to all this, but if you have time for one more, it will make the point even better, which is the priest, minister, and rabbi are talking about the money that they collect and what they do with it. And the priest says, look, we have a long-standing tradition in the church. We draw a circle on the ground, and we throw the money up, and we say whatever lands in the circle belongs to us, and whatever is outside the circle belongs to God. The minister says, we do something similar, a little bit different. We throw all the money up. Whatever lands on heads belongs to us. Whatever is tails belongs to God. And the rabbi said, it's not so different. I throw the money up. I figure whatever God wants, he keeps. Whatever comes down belongs to us. Now, when all these jokes, and there are more, obviously, what all these jokes have in common is that they portray the rabbi, and here the rabbi is not a rabbi, it's a stand-in for the Jew, right? They portray the Jewish person as favoring cleverness. And that's really what it is that the joke is advancing, is it's not about spirituality. It's about being smart. And that's a paradox in a way, because all the prayers we just said and all the prayers we will say, you will find almost not a single word about being clever. And yet, if I tell you typical Jewish stories, you'll look for that twist, for that cleverness, for that sense that the world is absurd and how do you wring some advantage from it. But take it from me, if you look through the Machzor or you look through the prayer book, that ideal is not actually an ideal. And part of the reason that that is so, part of the reason, I'll come to the second reason in a minute, is that we live in a world that is in fact somewhat governed by absurdity. Especially in the modern world. And it's hard to see it without that sharpness and without that sense that at any moment things could turn. This year, for the first time, I read about the man who might be the most important man in the 20th century, and yet I never heard his name. I don't know how many of you know about him. His name was Stanislav Petrov. He was the deputy chief for combat algorithms at SETCA 15, which was the nerve center of the Soviet Union's early warning system. And fortunately for us, Petrov was not a man easily given to panic. Because on September 26th, that is tomorrow, in 1983, a siren went off in his command station that showed that a missile had been launched from Montana. And his job was to report that to the duty officer who would tell Andropov, who would order a counterstrike. That's what he was supposed to do. But he wrote the algorithms, and so he decided this must be a mistake. And he told the duty officer, this is a mistake. But then, after they checked the system and checked it again, the lights went on again. And it said, launch high reliability. Now, 6 months earlier, the president of the United States, Ronald Reagan, had called the Soviet Union an evil empire. A few months after that, a South Korean airliner with a U.S. congressman aboard had flown over Soviet airspace and had been shot down by the Soviet Union. Petrov knew this. But he couldn't believe that without any warning, without any ground troops, that a single launch from Montana would be the signal for the end of the world. And so he said later, with his knees weak, he told the duty officer again, it's a mistake, don't report it. Because of that, on September 27th, 1983, the world was not in flames. 12,000 Soviet ballistic missiles stayed in their silos because of one man who has a good claim to having saved the world, even though most of us never heard his name. Now, how do you live in a world in which, had this guy done what he was supposed to do, none of us would be sitting here today? This is the 100th anniversary of the First World War. This year, 1914. What you may not realize is nobody expected that war to come about. In fact, the three principal actors, King George in England, Tsar Nicholas in Russia, Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany, they were all cousins. They all knew each other. They sort of grew up together. But in a few short weeks, with one trigger assassination, and by the way, Franz Ferdinand was assassinated because the car had to be diverted and took a route it wasn't supposed to take and happened to run right into Prince Ip, who was waiting with a gun. The world went up in flames and millions and millions and millions of people died, and the Middle East got carved up into the ridiculous divisions that still plague it today. We saw all this, we Jews. And the unthinkability of the world, for good and for bad, has been the story of our people. On the one hand, for good, where a Petrov stands up and says this can't happen, and on the other, for bad, where the world goes up in flames. Imagine the proverbial Martian coming to Earth. Who would believe that the greatest empires in the history of the world, the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the Ottoman Empire, that all of them are gone without a trace. And that only one nation survived all of them and continues to survive even when they're gone. But at the same time, who would believe that that one small nation has been hated throughout that time, has been persecuted throughout that time, is the only nation in the world for which there is a special word to describe the hatred of that people? On the one hand, it is unthinkable that a nation, after thousands of years, would return to its land, revive its language, build an army, and unthinkable that they have to build an army. that for almost 70 years there has been a continuous and concerted effort to wipe them out. Those two poles of unbelievable good fortune and remarkable tragedy have pursued us throughout Jewish history, even this summer. It is unthinkable that the largest pro-Israel demonstration in the world took place in a city in which there were no Jews. Calcutta. Calcutta, India, had the largest pro-Israel demonstration anywhere where Hindus and Sikhs and Buddhists affirmed Israel's right to exist. In China, where there are no Jews, except for some synagogue members doing business, in China, social media was overwhelmingly pro-Israel. The most vigorous defense of the delinkage of Israel's behavior in anti-Semitism, condemning anti-Semitism all across the world, was delivered, of all things, by the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel. Who would believe such things in front of this crowd of Kurds and Syrian Christians and Africans? Thousands of them, she spoke those words. Who would believe that Azerbaijan, a Muslim country, would be one of Israel's staunchest allies? But equally unthinkable would be that the world press, faced with millions killed in Congo, with China gradually destroying Tibet, with Boko Haram kidnapping and murdering all across Nigeria, with Muslim fundamentalism spreading across the globe, would spend the summer pounding Israel. It is unthinkable that after thousands of years of wandering across the globe, we would find the United States and here live in safety and prosperity and have a land of Israel to call our own. And unthinkable that one of the first places that gave us refuge, that then was called Persia and now is called Iran, is pursuing a weapon that could wipe out the state of Israel in a matter of seconds. If you want history to make sense, don't study the Jews. Why have we developed this strange sense of ourselves as both spiritual and clever, both smart and exalted, because we have been so buffeted by the winds of history that we couldn't have any single sense of ourselves because we needed more skills than that to exist? We are the people of the paradox. We came from dictatorships and built a democracy. In an area of the world where it's all about oil, we create software companies. We're successful but besieged, faithful but skeptical, proud but self-critical, protective but argumentative, suspicious but warm, filled with sadness. And in love with joy. We are a strange and paradoxical and remarkable people. And you see it in our humor, in our literature, in our prayers, in our nation. We dance on the edge of a knife and we celebrate in shadows, and there will be on this Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, I have no doubt, some of my colleagues who will get up and speak to their congregations all about the dangers that face the Jewish people. But to speak about danger without speaking about gratitude is wrong. Hakarat hatov, recognition of blessing, of what is good, is as great a mitzvah as recognition of danger. And the real message at this instant in history is I am looking right now at the luckiest Jews who ever lived. And at a group who must be the most vigilant, the most awake, the most unillusioned. It was just yesterday, as if in preparation, that on the cover of the New York Times, there was an article that went on and on inside about the resurgence of anti-Semitism in Europe. As I sat there in a quiet neighborhood in Westwood and looked out at a giant synagogue across the street and knew that thousands of people would come in here over the next several days in peace and security to pray in a way that we never did in the history of Jewish life anywhere. I thought about that strange mix of blessing and threat, of gratitude and danger, that always threaded its way through Jewish life, but especially today. It is our responsibility to remember that we have powerful, ruthless, and vicious enemies. We do. It seems hard to imagine sometimes when we sit here, but you know, you've seen. And it is our responsibility to defend our people and our land because of our blessing, because we have power, and to model that for our children, and not to tell our children how lucky they are, but to tell them how lucky we are. To let them know how grateful we are to live in the world that we do and show them the responsibility that it imposes. And to teach them that we have friends as well as enemies, power as well as threats, intellect and resources and leadership, and an astonishing determination to survive. Don't make the mistake of showing them a good life and telling them only terrible things. One of the critical moments in our story is when Jacob, with cunning, steals the birthright from his older brother Esau. And in one way he steals it, and in another way he didn't, because Esau sort of sold it to him under duress. But let us say that if you're looking for examples of sharp business practices in the Torah, Jacob is your man. But you remember what Isaac says? Isaac says, the hands are the hands of Esau, but the voice, it's the voice of Jacob. Throughout Jewish history, our ancestors have quoted that verse, that the voice is the voice of Jacob and the hands of Esau. And they have said how much we have suffered in this world at the hands of Esau. But they also remind us again and again that there is nothing ultimately more powerful in this world than the voice of Jacob. Why are we here? Despite all the empires that I mentioned and all the persecution, it's because of the voice of Jacob. Because of the words of our tradition, and sometimes the way in which they were spun in cleverness, in humor, but also in eloquence, in determination, and because one thing the world could not do was silence us. Even out of the flames of our greatest persecution came some of our greatest writers and teachers and poets and thinkers. We are the voice of Jacob. And if we don't speak up, then we lose the great power that was given to us by our tradition and by our ancestors. So if there is a mandate for the Jewish people, it is this, that in the year to come, You must raise your voice. You must let people know what it is that you see happening in the world and not let them ignore it and not let them forget. Remember that we are to be in the divine image, and what we read in the Psalms is Shomer Yisrael, the God of Israel, Lo Yanum Velo Yishan, does not slumber nor sleep, neither may we. The danger is too great, and we are too lucky. We have a voice. We have lots of voices, and lots of power, and lots of wealth, and lots of resources. Use it. Here's the mission. Not just to remember that we are the luckiest Jews who ever lived. But one day, to make sure that our children and grandchildren and their grandchildren will be able to say the same thing. Shana Tova.